It's been anarchy on the Obisk today and on the climbs that preceded it in the Pyrenees. I'm standing on top of the mountain at the end of stage 14 of the Vuelta a España. To my right, Robert Hessink is on the podium collecting his prize for winning the stage. Around about 15 minutes ago, he crossed the line ahead of Kenny Elissond and Igor Silin. A great victory for him, but it really was a stage for the ages. Completely uncontrolled racing most of the day. Riders all over the road. There was an attempted coup by Simon Yates and Orica Bike Exchange, with several of his teammates helping him gain time overall. Still don't know exactly what damage he's managed to do to the overall, but he's certain to have moved up from 7th place. There are attacks by Nairo Quintana, by Alberto Contador, by Esteban Chavez, by Samuel Sanchez, all of which gained a little and then settled back into the groove. Valverde, in fact, cracked and fell away from third place overall, and Chris Froome had an answer for every question that Nairo Quintana posed on the mountain. The stage itself then was a battle between little and large. Kenny Elissond, who's tiny, and Robert Hessink, who towered over him and did most of the work on the mountain, it has to be said. Medium-sized Igor Silin was hoping to get the better of them, but he was unable to match Hessink's power at the line. And the riders are going to keep coming in now, I suspect, for the next 30 minutes. I wonder whether anyone will be in danger of missing the time cut today.
You're listening to the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Well, I've made it down off the Col d'Aubisque to Guret. Not too bad, the traffic jam off the mountain today. The crowds were quite big, but not Tour de France size crowds. And I'm down here at the press room with Fran Reyes from Ciclismo a Fondo. Fran, what's your assessment of the stage? Because I thought it was one of the most exciting days Grand Tour racing I've seen for a long time.
Well, it was definitely great. You know, in the end, we saw today the face-to-face between Nairo Quintana and Chris Froome that we were hoping to watch in the Tour de France, which unfortunately didn't happen. So, yeah, for this, from that point of view, it was outstanding. But what made the stage really awesome was the tactics from Orica Greenedge, even from the same Movistar team, even if it failed a bit because of Alejandro Valverde losing time. But yeah, it was a stage that was interesting from the start to the finish, and a stage that really hurt the cyclist's legs for 200 kilometers, you know.
And it's only now that we're holding the results in our hands and we get to see exactly what damage has been done. I mean, I hadn't realised, I was standing up there on the finish line and I hadn't realised how much time Valverde had lost. I gather you heard what he said at the finish.
Yeah, he was speaking to the radio, Spanish radio stations. He was asked straight away that whether this was a bad day or just the legs he has. And his answer was quite clear. What you see is what there is. I am totally empty.
Well, he's lost 10 minutes and any chance of finishing on the podium, or any chance of the top 10, really. But his teammate, Nairo Quintana, he tried to crack Chris Froome, but at the moment, Chris Froome has an answer for everything on the climbs.
Yeah, you know, they are always alluding and, you know, saying that the advantage Chris Froome has on the climbs is because of the power meters and because of how good he paces himself with the help of this machine, but in the end, he definitely has the best climbing legs of this Vuelta, along with those of Nairo Quintana. If you analyze the attacks from Nairo today, he attacked for 5 seconds and then immediately looked backwards to see whether he had made Froome crack or not, and he didn't. He never managed to get off him to get a gap of more than 10 meters, maybe.
And we know that Chris Froome will wait and wait, and he'll make his response when he's ready, and he'll close a gap, sometimes quickly, but sometimes gradually, at the pace he feels comfortable with. And it must be very hard for the other riders, because it doesn't appear that there's any way to crack Chris Froome, and the advantage Nairo Quintana has at the moment isn't enough for the time trial. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it definitely isn't. You know, it's 37 kilometers of time trial, if I'm not mistaken, and, you know, only with a 2 second gap, a 2 second gain per kilometer, Chris Froome is beating Nairo. Even if Movistar sometimes take this narrative or saying, hey, it's us who are ahead of Froome in the GC, they know that that is a reality more or less virtual, you know. So they need to gain time, and today their tactics were made to gain time on Froome, you know, maybe with Valverde rather than with Nairo, but they know that they have to beat him still.
And what about Alberto Contador? A few days ago, the tape on his leg was Spanish colours, like the Spanish flag. It's white today, like the flag of surrender. It looks like any chance for him has gone. I mean, is this the end of Alberto Contador as a GC rider?
I don't know if it is the end, but he's totally fading out, you know. He had a slight chance of winning this Vuelta, you know, in this talking from the stage one. He had a slight chance of winning this Vuelta if Froome and Nairo weren't at the top of their game. But with them on this level of performance, he can match that. He really can't match them. Even Esteban Chavez seems to be out of his reach. So he probably can't hope for... He definitely can't hope for victory, and he probably can't hope even for podium finish.
And the Vuelta, I mean, every year in recent years, the racing is so open, and the riders are less reserved. They are prepared to take more risks. We saw today Simon Yates, seventh overall, trying to pull off an amazing coup. You wouldn't see that attempt in the Tour de France. The rider in seventh place wouldn't make that effort to try and gain some places. Samuel Sanchez, who I think was 10th this morning, also trying to attack, maybe to gain a few places. Why is it that riders are more willing to try things in the Vuelta? Is it because the stakes aren't quite as high as the Tour de France? Everyone is happy to have 7th, 8th, 9th in the Tour, whereas in the Vuelta they can maybe gamble for a little bit more?
Yeah, I think that there are two main factors here. First, the one you say, the pressure is way weaker here than in the Tour de France. And second, it's not about the riders, but about the teams. You know, the level of the teams as a whole, they are way weaker than they are at the Tour de France. You know, today we saw Sky pulling from the peloton and getting to the second to last climb with only four riders, something that wouldn't happen in the Tour de France. In the Tour de France, they would have been with seven riders maybe to pull for Froome in the second to last climb, and we'll be at the foot of the last climb with five. No, since the teams have worn off during the season, now the attackers really have a chance of making it to the finish line or maybe getting a result that satisfies them. You know.
And lastly, what are you expecting from the remaining days in the Vuelta? What should we look forward to? You know the country. Tell me what I should be looking forward to as I travel down towards Alicante.
Well, first of all, the beach. You know, we all miss the beach. At least I do. But from a sporting point of view, I think that the most interesting stage will definitely be the time trial. The rest of the stages, there is one steep summit climb, summit finish, which is Mas de la Costa. Peñagolosa is a funny climb, but I am not quite sure whether it will make a lot of difference between the main riders. And as for Formigal and Aitana, those are steady climbs, you know. Formigal tomorrow has an advantage, you know, in order to see some show between the main riders, which is that the stage is so short, you know, and the terrain is tricky. This stage has been designed by Fernando Escartín, the Vuelta technical director, who lives there. You know, actually, he's from Biescas, which is the equator of tomorrow's stage, if I'm not mistaken right now. So he really knows how to make it in order to hurt. And I think the 120 kilometers from tomorrow are going to be breathless, you know, restless for the riders.
That's Fernando Escartín, who was third in the 1999 Tour de France. What was his best result in the Vuelta? Did he get on the podium here as well?
Yeah, he did a handful of times, but he never managed to win it. You know, in the end, he was one of these suffering climbers who never really won anything that were that are so loved by the Spanish aficionado.
He was like Jaime Zubeldia, but one level above.
Yeah, you know, Fernando Escartín actually did have some wine in his face from time to time. You know, Jaime Zubeldia is now that we are seeing him attacking of some sort, you know, some sort of attacking. But no, it was Fernando Escartín was way more courageous and took a lot more of chances than Aymar.
Thanks very much. Enjoy your evening, Fran.
Yeah, thank you very much, Lionel.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
So that was me back in France. Feels like hours and hours ago. That's because it was hours and hours ago.
It was like podcasting in a foreign country, wasn't it?
I'm back over the border now in Spain with Daniel Freib. Evening, Daniel.
It's very late, isn't it? It's a very Spanish podcast. It's quintessentially Spanish podcast.
It is. It's been traumatic getting across the border. Massive
you
traffic
must
jam.
You must have enjoyed the drive over the Portale there.
I would have done, but it was pitch black, I didn't get treated to the views. But I gather the views are stunning, aren't they?
Absolutely spectacular. As are the views, or as is the scenery on most of the passes that go from France into Spain and vice versa.
It's pretty spectacular up on the Col du Bisc, I have to say. I remember riding up that way in 2011 from Guret up to the top. And when I got to the top, I stood and watched the race come past. I think it was a day Tor Hushov won down in either Lourdes or Pau. Struggling to remember the details. But what I do remember is that as one of the Sky cars came past, Shane Sutton leant out of the back window and said, "How was it? Would have been easier if you'd left your gut at the bottom." So that was Shane Sutton there giving me a bit of motivational talk. Anyway, move on from that. Let's do an unconventional tale of the etapa. Tale of the etapa.
Where are we, first line?
Oh, where are we? Well, I don't know where we are. Where are we?
We're in a place called Sabiñánigo, it's at the foot of the Portale on the Spanish side. And we went through Formigal on the way here, which is a big ski resort. Basically this side of the Obisque in Spain, and we're in a fairly deserted, well, village square, aren't we?
Yeah.
There are a few people knocking around.
Yeah, I mean, you've had some tapas by the looks of it.
I've had a hamburger. That's what I've had. Oh. A very Spanish hamburger, though.
Oh. Okay, well, I had a lomo roll, so pork slices with a kind of quite a piquant sauce that came with it, but it wasn't great. I grabbed that from the side of the road as I was stuck in traffic.
I do admire, though, Lionel, the way that of all the stages, of all the times to drop into the Vuelta, you tried your hardest to drop in Catalay country, which was impossible, which was impossible because we weren't staying really anywhere on the French side of the Pyrenees. But you gave it a good shot, didn't you?
Yeah, it would have been easier to drive up to Revel for dinner this evening than the drive I've done. Anyway, let's get back to what was, I think, one of the finest Grand Tour stages certainly in recent memory. I can't think of another one. I asked Fran Reyes whether he could think of another one. I said earlier in the podcast it was anarchy on the Obisque, but it was anarchy the whole day long. So I'll just, if I did a full-on tale of the etapa this evening, then it would be gone midnight before I finished. But here the brief highlights of what I can remember happened, the most significant things that happened today on stage 14 to the top of the Col d'Obisque in the Pyrenees. The first thing that really put the cat among the pigeons was Dani Moreno of Movistar getting into the big break at the start. They got so far up the road, over 5.5 minutes, that Moreno, who was 12th overall, was the virtual leader for a short while. And that took the pressure off Movistar quite a lot and perhaps put Sky in a bit of a quandary, although they had David Lopez up the road as well. It was all, there was an awful lot of early shadow boxing, wasn't there, to presumably try and set things up for the Obisque. The breakaway split into bits on the Marie Blanc, which was really, looked really hard. We know it's a hard climb. It looked hard. Then there was a great move by Orica Bike Exchange. They had riders in the early break. Then Jack Haig, young Australian, made a move which helped Simon Yates, nearly said Sean Yates there, saw Sean Yates at the top of the Obisque. Simon Yates then bridged across, and then they all joined up in the on the descent and for the valley ride, and then Simon Yates was riding his way right up the general classification. I think now is in fourth place behind his teammate Esteban Chavez. Oh, my beer has arrived. That's lovely. Thank you, Daniel.
Estrella Galicia, and we know we're near Galicia, but we did spend a lot of time in Galicia. Anyway, Lionel, go on.
So just to recap the stage, the battle up at the front was Robert Hessink, Kenny Elissonde and Igor Cilin. As I said earlier on, it was little and large, and a medium-sized rider as well getting involved. Robert Hessink won the stage. Terrific victory for him. He's had a really hard time both on and off the bike, really, for the last couple of years. And Kenny Elissonde's prize for the day was to take over the King of the Mountains jersey.
King Kenny.
King Kenny. King Kenny. Yes, there we go. Brilliant.
We love Kenny. We love Kenny.
Brilliant. And Alejandro Valverde, the big casualty, lost over 10 minutes and has plummeted down the overall standings. Nairo Quintana and Chris Froome were not really trading blows, because Chris Froome didn't really do much to attack. He just made it known that he was Quintana's equal. And Quintana, you know, he did that thing where he accelerates, he hangs out there by sort of 50 or 100 metres and then lets everybody catch up. So that was the day. Nairo Quintana is still in the overall lead. Chris Froome still second. And Esteban Chavez is third. Let's hear very quickly from a couple of the protagonists of the day. At the top of the Obisque, I spoke to George Bennett, who played a big part in Robert Hessink's win for Team Lotto NL Jumbo, and also Simon Yates, who wasn't in the most talkative of moods, but he was, in fairness, absolutely knackered. George, that worked out perfectly for the team, and you played your part.
Yeah, that was a big day, an exciting day, huge team effort as well. You know, that was a really beautiful win. Just Robert being super strong, it was the whole team being strong and motivated.
It was complete anarchy on the Col d'Aubisque, and in fact all day though, wasn't it?
The Aubisque, the last one. Yeah, fuck.
Yeah, this one here that we're on now.
Yeah, that was, full gas. That's how I love to race, and a special day.
Did you and Robert have a chance to talk much at all?
Yeah, we talked a lot, and that was the plan, you know. I was there in the front, attacked on the downhill, so he could stay fresh in the wheels. And then, on the climb, it was the other way around. You know, he was the aggressor, and I just followed everybody and sapped them that way, you know.
And he's had such a tough time for a year, 2 years, hasn't he? It's a very sweet victory for him.
Yeah, I was just saying, Robert's had more bad luck than almost any other rider, and he's so mentally strong and works so hard, so it's really special to see him come back like that.
Well, enjoy it this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Simon, terrific ride today, but a real team effort, wasn't it?
Yeah, made a plan at the start and executed it to how we wanted. And, I don't know. I don't really know the result because I was pretty tired there, so I don't even know how I've done, but whatever. I give it full gas and it is what it is.
How helpful was it to see riders coming back towards you on the final climb, giving you something to chase all the time?
As in other teams, there's a lot of riders up the road. It's normal, a lot of guys are tired. And I was in the bunch all day, so I'm going to be a lot fresher, and I think it's normal.
So, Daniel, the thing that struck me was it was a day for teamwork, wasn't it? Movistar were playing soldiers with their men. Sky kind of doing the same on a smaller scale. Team Lotto NL Jumbo played a blinder, and so did Orica Bike Exchange.
Yeah, and the day looked as though it was going to be all about Movistar, but Movistar cocked it up in the way that only they know how. No, I mean, that's maybe harsh, but it really underlines the point and bears out the point that you can employ whatever tactics you want, but if your leaders don't have the legs to finish the job. And, you know, it reminded me very much of the stage to Bagnères de Bigorre in 2013 Tour de France, when Movistar really had Froome up on the ropes, and they'd got rid of all of his teammates. Well, Garmin actually got rid of his teammates very quickly. Froome was left on his own, and there were six Movistar riders at one point, one Sky rider. I think over the final two climbs, there were six Movistar riders, or certainly when they began the penultimate climb, and they failed to land a blow, really. And it was very similar today. It could have been panic stations for Team Sky. I spoke to a few of their guys, Dave Brailsford and Froome himself, at the end of the stage, and you know, they said they kind of toyed with the idea, or they could have try to send Kenyuk or maybe another rider after the big 41-man break this morning, but they felt that it was smarter to just ride tempo on the front, which was a very kind of confident move, a very self-assured move, really. It would have been easy to panic in that situation. When it came down to the final climb, you know, it was mano a mano, and Froome is as strong as Quintana. Well, pretty much as strong as Quintana, and I think Sky certainly feel that Froome is getting stronger, and Quintana might get weaker as this race progresses. Interesting take from a couple of people at Sky about the time that Quintana needs going into the final time trial, and Quintana and Movistar have peddled this line that he needs at least 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes, or they've even said three on occasion. At Team Sky, they feel that 40 seconds might be enough for Quintana, and that whether he's playing mind games or completely miscalculating, they feel that he's a good enough time trialer, Quintana, to only lose 40 seconds from Chris Froome. So if that is the case, then it's Froome that has to gain time at the moment, not Quintana.
Well, I mean, if you think about it sort of ruthlessly, 2 seconds a kilometre over 37 kilometres would give Chris Froome 1.25 minutes, and that's enough to win the Vuelta as it stands at the moment. And 2 seconds a kilometre isn't being outlandish, even 3 seconds a kilometre. It might not all happen at once. It might be quite level pegging to start with. And obviously there's stages to go before then. There's tricky. It's tricky territory rather than out-and-out climbing territory.
Particularly
now.
Tomorrow, you know, an 118-kilometre stay tomorrow. We know we've become very well accustomed over the past few years to what drama those very, very short stages can offer up. And tomorrow, I think, is a stage that everyone in the peloton or everyone in the race will be absolutely dreading. Apart from whoever it is that decides that tomorrow is their day to blow the race apart. Because the race is going to blow apart from the gun. It always does on those very short stages.
The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa.
So, Daniel, as you'd expect, Robert Hesink was all smiles at the top of the Col d'Aubisque this afternoon. Big bear hug from one of his support staff and a whoop from Hesink, because that victory meant a lot to him. It's been a very difficult time, as I said, on and off the bike for Hesink. His father was killed in a cycling accident a few years ago. He was diagnosed with an irregular heartbeat. Had other personal problems. He had injuries as well. I think he broke his leg. And it's a long, long time since he won a major bike race. He won the Grand Prix Quebec in Canada in 2013, but a long, long time since he's been up there in contention for a Grand Tour stage win. He finished sixth in the Vuelta in 2012, I think. And there was a period where, on the final climb, when he had Kenny Elissonde in his not inconsiderable...
Hang on, Lionel. Can we refer to Kenny Elissonde from now on
as King Kenny? There was a time, Daniel, where Robert Hesink had King Kenny in his not inconsiderable slipstream, because it really was...
It was like a father taking his little boy out for a bike ride, wasn't it?
It was. And Hesink taught him a lesson or two at the end. I mean, he had the strength, obviously, but he played it very well. I mean, he wasn't lulled into playing games. He just kept the tempo high. You know, huge sort of gear he seemed to be turning at times on the climb. And even when Igor Sillin came up to him, he didn't panic. Kenny Elissonde didn't take advantage of that. And, impressive win for Hesink.
Yeah, it was. And as you say, he's almost a tragic hero of modern cycling. He's had so much go wrong in the last few years. And he's a very popular rider. I don't really know anyone who's got a bad word to say about Robert Hesink. And, you know, not just off the bike. He's had his troubles off the bike, but on the bike as well. You know, lots of crashes, real problems with descending that he tried to remedy and has sort of remedied. It was a smart win. I was standing on the climb at about 6 kilometres from the top, and at that point he was ahead with Jan Bakelants, and you obviously thought that Hesink would be the stronger climber of those two. But then when King Kenny came back up to him, and Igor Sillin, who is very motivated because he's riding, well, he doesn't have a deal currently for next year, so he's sort of riding for his future. You did fear a little bit for Hesink, but he finished the job off.
Yeah, very nice guy. I mean, remember in the Vuelta, he was in with a shout of the podium, and a crash cost him then when he did finish sixth. He slipped down quite near the end of the race, I think. And once went and visited him at his home in the Netherlands.
What's the name of the place? It's the same town as Varsseveld.
Varsseveld, yes, it is. Good.
Same town as Goose Hiddink.
Is that right?
Yeah, and Goose Hiddink. And in Varsseveld, do you know what there is? There's a Gooseum. There's a museum dedicated to Goose Hiddink, the famous football manager, that they call the Gooseum.
Wow. What on earth is in the Gooseum?
The Condor of Varsseveld. That's his nickname, isn't it? That's his terrible, contrived nickname. Anyway.
I asked him how he relaxed, because he had a bookshelf which didn't have many books on it, and he said he liked to play Pro Cycling Manager as himself. I think I've said that before on the podcast, but that sticks out. Anything else of note from today's stage? I mean, Orica Bike Exchange, that was a clearly very well thought out move. Almost half the team totally committed to trying to make it happen. Well, the whole team totally committed to trying to make it happen, because the other team members would have been doing all the legwork early on in the stage, and several riders up the road, and it all seemed to slot together perfectly. They were all in just... It was like the cards all falling face up, really, though, wasn't it? You can't plan it to that extent. You can only put the men in position and hope that circumstances turn out the way you want.
Yeah, I've rarely seen such a... Well, a tactical, what looked like a tactical masterstroke we pulled off to that extent. As you say, a lot of teams try that. There are teams that try that kind of tactic on almost every mountain stage in every major tour, but it's very rare that they're able to pull it off. And Simon Yates is starting to look, well, he does look incredibly strong, doesn't he? And at this point, he's just adrift of Esteban Chavez on the general classification. They're both, I think Chavez is just over 2 minutes, and Yates about 16 seconds behind Chavez. They're looking very, very dangerous, and possibly at this point more dangerous than Valverde ever was as a foil for Quintana, because I think, you know, as I said before, Movistar have been in the position to hurt Team Sky many times in Grand Tours over the past 3 or 4 years and have failed to do so. Whereas you watch something like today that Orica Bike Exchange were able to do, and you think that they might not cock it up to the same extent. And, you know, if they might play those two cars to better effect than Movistar have done in the past few years. I'm talking, of course, about Chavez and Yates.
I was talking earlier to Fran, which you won't have heard, Daniel, about how the Vuelta differs to the Tour de France and why we see so much more aggressive, so much more adventurous racing. And today was both aggressive, adventurous, brinksmanship in some cases. I mean, really sort of bold, gritty, tactical moves, people risking an awful lot. And I made the point to Fran that in the Tour de France, you don't see 7th place like Simon Yates or 10th place like Sammy Sanchez trying anything at all in a mountain stage. But the Vuelta and Orica Bike Exchange in particular, as they look another year, 2 years down the line with this clutch now of GC riders that they've got, the two Yates brothers and Esteban Chavez, it's almost like they're, you know, trying things out. That today would have built an awful lot of confidence, would have given them belief, and given Simon Yates particularly belief that you can achieve things. I mean, he wasn't riding away from people who weren't interested. He was riding away from and holding a gap over a group that was attacking each other. Contador was having a dig, Quintana was having a dig. So an awful lot of positives for them to take out of today, I would have thought.
Yeah, and again, it was another example of what we saw in the Tour de France with Adam Yates, just the incredible maturity of those brothers. Usually riders of that age, you would expect them to be impetuous and to try things and for them not to come off. But, you know, he's tried two big moves now in this Vuelta, Simon Yates. One of them resulted in a stage win, and one of them resulted in him really, well, upsetting the apple cart and putting himself into contention on general classification. And obviously you have to have the legs to do so, and they're both extremely strong riders, but they have this coolness about them, which is very impressive to see.
Well, the stage started in the Basque Country. Boudin Noir, black pudding from this part of the world, isn't it? Berry is the undisputed home of black pudding, also the undisputed home of the Yates brothers. You know, they'll be dining out on black pudding tonight, no doubt, at the Orica Bike Exchange. I have no doubt that that's happening now. They'll be having it on toast.
I'm in the Team Sky and Movistar Hotel on a golf course. I might sneak in around tomorrow morning.
Well, it's a very late start tomorrow, Daniel, so you'll have time, even if you're sort of, you know, deliberating over all every putt, looking at them from every angle. What's it like, the golf course? Nice?
I think designed by Jose Maria Olazabal, who was my hero growing up, as well as, you know, with Pavel Tonkov, Frank Vandenbroucke. There were a few, to be fair.
Yeah, I wonder what links them. Kind of
flawed mercurial geniuses.
Yeah, interesting. Just on talking about accommodation, I bumped into Gary Beckett, who's a soigneur from the Cannondale team, in the hotel this morning, and it was a nice hotel, wasn't it, we were in last night, that Cannondale were in, and he was saying that some of their hotels had been really pretty poor. They've been in sort of 15 or 20 euro a night truck stops, where the team chef had taken such pity on the staff. Normally the staff will eat the food that the hotel's laying on, and the riders will eat the food that the chef is making, but the chefs took, Sean Fowler and his wife, the chefs for the Cannondale team, took pity on the staff and rustled them up something, because they were not going to get fed well.
Yeah, but I think that's probably one of the perils of starting the of having the race in Galicia. You know, I talked a fair bit about Galicia, the pros and cons of the gifts and the curses of Galicia in earlier podcasts, and I think tourism there is a fairly new phenomenon. Mass tourism, I don't think there's any real mass tourism even now, but probably not an awful lot of hotels that have the capacity for multiple teams or even one team, so they're probably scratching around a little bit, the organisers, to house teams. I can imagine it would have been potluck. I, of course, stayed in some wonderful places. Castles, these incredible haciendas sweeping views over the Galician hills. Yeah,
beautiful. Well, when we get down to Benidorm, what sort of accommodation will there be down there?
I would imagine it would be perfect for bike teams in Benidorm, because there'll be some huge hotels, very modern. Mm-hmm. The team chefs will be able to move their kitchens in and take over. And I think that'll be... There'll be no complaints about that.
And then it will be shots on the beach at sort of 2 a.m, no doubt.
See you there, Lionel.
Well, it's been a long day on the Vuelta today. I listened to the podcast when Richard was here, and it sounded like a holiday, frankly. Short days and late mornings and hours spent on the beach enjoying himself. It's been a bit of a trial for me so far. I've found it logistically challenging. It's frankly bloody typical, isn't it?
It's become logistically challenging to coincide with your arrival. It wasn't previously.
No, today was interesting. I mean, I remember when the tour went up to the finished on the Obisque in 07, and that was an absolute that was a disaster zone, wasn't it, getting off the mountain that day. The tour, of course, is vast, and it really struck me how much smaller the Vuelta is, seeing how little of the infrastructure was needed up there today. Yes, there was a big traffic jam, but it wasn't anything like the tour scale. It was just but the Vuelta, it has got a lovely laid back feel. It's been a few years since I've been here. I've enjoyed reacquainting myself with it. Looking forward to exploring the real Spain now that we're away from France. So join us again tomorrow. Where will we be?
Formigal. Just up the valley, isn't it?
Yeah, but we've got a bit of a drive after the stage, haven't we? Head down into past Zaragoza and
but downwards. I did a bit of a Vincenzo Nibali, and I thought the rest day was the Monday, but it's actually Tuesday. I heard another one about Nibali. Nibali famously one year, what was it? There was year 2012, wasn't it? He thought that he was very bullish about his chances in the time trial that year in the Tour de France, and then it was pointed out to him that it wasn't the team time trial, and he was astonished because he was absolutely he was convinced that it was a team time trial, and it was individual time trial. Apparently there's another one this year at the Giro, the Dolomite stage. He'd completely, I think he might have even recce'd the stage, but he'd completely forgotten to recce the Passo Giao, and then that morning, a day or two before the big Dolomite stage, someone talked to him about the Passo Giao, and he looked at them quizzically, and he hadn't realised the Passo Giao was on the route.
Well, hopefully the riders...
Again, tawdry speculation. I'm not sure any of this is true. This is the kind of story you get told by by unreliable colleagues.
Well, if anyone's listened this deep in, you know, don't hold it against Daniel if that doesn't turn out to be true. Let's hope that the riders don't assume that tomorrow's stage, just because it's short, is going to be easy. I'm sure they won't. It's going to be fast, explosive, very difficult, particularly towards the end. We could see some kind of ambush. Who knows? It's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because then the race does sort of settle into a bit of a groove for a few days, and everyone's looking towards that time trial now, and when we'll gather a bit of information over the next couple of mornings, I think, to see who people think has got the upper hand in the time trial. But for now, that's all from the Cycling Podcast here in Spain. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Lionel Burney. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Lionel.